A few weeks ago, I received a phone call from a young woman asking if she could see me soon. She had just received word that her sister had been killed in an auto accident, a head-on collision. In my office, she spoke of her sister's death with unusual calm. Her sister had been to her the most significant member in her family. At times, she teared, but she seemed to have an inner strength and a quietness that in the light of her history was quite surprising. As she left my office, she mentioned how much her Christian faith, which was very new to her, had sustained her in this crisis, had already helped sustain her. I couldn't help but think back to when this young lady, now in her middle 20s, first consulted me. She was an undergraduate. She was a sensitive, highly intelligent, unusually attractive girl. But she was in great turmoil, depressed, anxious, and finding it extremely difficult to function. She cried for long periods in her room. She spoke of being confused over who she was and what she wanted to become. She was lonely and unable to establish a satisfying relationship with anyone. She was extremely uncomfortable with people. She felt inadequate, and her image of herself was not very positive. She had little self-esteem. She was sexually promiscuous. The many men in her life were merely vague, transient, shadowy figures with whom her relationships were empty and frustrating. She used them to prove to herself that she was a woman and that she was desirable, but they meant nothing to her. She just could not give of herself. She found it impossible to invest herself emotionally in anyone. She was confused over what was right and wrong. Her nominal religious faith was demolished by some of her courses in philosophy soon after entering college. At one point, she wrote her parents asking them for guidance and commenting, "Please, please tell me what to do." And they wrote back saying, "Cheer up. We know what you're going through. You have to make up your own mind." And her father sent her the name of a gynecologist to whom she could go to for contraceptive advice. In her last year in college, she was exposed through her coursework to the works of Milton, Chaucer, Spencer, and eventually to C.S. Lewis. And she began to learn for the first time in her life a little bit about Christianity and to grapple with some of its issues. She talked about these things freely with me, and she commented that if there was any truth to Christianity, it then offered a hope for her and a resolution to the devastating despair that she felt. In time, she embraced the Christian faith. Today, this young lady is working in a job with considerable responsibility. Her name often appears in the newspapers. She's also, for the first time in her life, established a close, meaningful relationship with a young man who shares her faith and to whom she will be married in the spring. Now, I would like to give this lady an arbitrary name. We'll call her Miss Carpenter, though the story that I've just told you is very true, and the incident, the accident happened just a few weeks ago. And I'd like to return to her from time to time in my comments this morning. A few months ago, I was speaking informally to a small group of medical students at the Harvard Medical School. And they asked some rather provoking questions. They asked, "Is there any evidence that Christians are less disturbed than others?" They said, "You know, this personal relationship with Christ, we know and hear often about the spiritual benefits, but is there any evidence that it can influence the practical living of our lives, of how we think and how we feel?" What they wanted to know was, does the Christian experience foster stability and maturity in an individual, or does it foster dependency and weakness? Now, with this question in mind, I'd like to discuss four criteria of emotional maturity. Now, if you know psychiatrists, you know that it's pretty difficult to get the two of them to agree fully on anything. But I think that most psychiatrists would agree with these four criteria. And I'd like to consider them briefly in light of Christian experience. One important element of emotional maturity is the capacity to love another person, to become sufficiently detached from one's personal needs and concerns, to be able to become aware of and sensitive to the needs of others. This, of course, is the key to all successful relationships, employer, employee, parent, child, social, marital, sexual. No commentator of human experience, whether it be an ancient Greek or a modern psychoanalyst, has failed to observe the importance of love and the capacity to love in human experience. A psychiatrist is intensely interested in how his patient relates to other people, for he realizes that the quality of these relationships is a pretty fair barometer of his patient's emotional health. When a man has severe inner conflict, the difficulty will often first manifest itself in that person's relationships with other people. All that we know about human behavior points to a universal need for close, enduring, warm, gratifying relationships with other human beings. Yet for many, this is the most difficult of all to attain. Men who have had all the culture that higher education can offer are often total failures in their relationships with people, within their marriages, which so often are multiple, or among their colleagues. There is little but tension, strife, anxiety, bitterness, and agonizing disappointment. It takes two very mature people to live together successfully. But what else makes success in this area of relationships between two people? What makes it so difficult to attain? Well, one reason, as I've implied, to put it very simply, is that for most people, there is a very limited capacity to step out of themselves long enough to become aware of the needs of others, a limited capacity to love. Relationships with others often are pathologically immature. An infant's attitude toward others is a very self-centered one, as you know. For him, another person exists only to the extent that that person can feed him, can give him warmth, or can provide for him one need or another. Without this satisfying of personal need, the other person just doesn't exist. And it's in this attitude, persisting in the adult, that produces the excessively narcissistic and self-centered individual whose relationships with others is an arid wasteland. Now, it seems to me if there's any change in an individual, objective as well as subjective, that Christ brings to a life, it's an increased capacity to love. To know Christ is to begin a venture in love. He commands us to love, and he brings us into contact with the ultimate source of love. In John we read, "For God is love." The scriptures abound with the word love. Christians are told to love one another and are given the provocative challenge of loving their enemies. The two great commandments, Jesus says, are to love God and to love our neighbor as ourselves. But this is the catch, as ourselves. Now, we hear it so often, to love your neighbor as yourself. It's almost a cliche. Yet it's really a revolutionary idea and a very, very difficult one to put into practice. The Bible takes for granted that we love ourselves. You know, there's no argument there about loving ourselves. And so does psychoanalysis. We may not like certain habits or certain faults or certain mistakes that we make, but we always love ourselves to the extent that we will the best for ourselves. From the time we brush our teeth in the morning till the time we brush our teeth at night, just about everything we do is because we will the best for ourselves, eating three meals a day, doing this and doing that. There's evidence that even a person who commits suicide does so because he feels that he's escaping from an intolerable situation to a less tolerable one. Now, one small aspect of loving a person as we love ourselves implies thinking about what his needs are. And this implies thinking about him as much as we think about ourselves. How much do we think about ourselves? How much are our preoccupations, our daydreams, concerned with things that we want to attain, that we want to achieve, with people that we want to impress? I'd say about 99.9%. Now, it seems to me that the first step, then, in loving another person as we love ourselves is to think about that other person or think about other people 50% of the time. 50% thinking about others 50% of the time and ourselves about 50% of the time. Is it humanly possible? I doubt it. That is, not without outside help. Most of God's standards, it seems to me, are humanly impossible. But in Christ they become possible, and it's in Him they become more than a cold, willful response to a commandment. He infuses into our hearts a concern and a compassion that makes one want to obey His commandment to love. It may be that through His forgiveness that we feel differently about ourselves and thus come to feel differently about others. I don't know how it happens. All I know is that it does happen. I know this from observation. I know it from personal experience. Miss Carpenter found that her Christian experience fostered in her an ability to love. A second aspect of a healthy personality is a sound, consistent conscience with well-defined moral precepts. That is to say, a clear understanding of what for me is right and what is wrong. Now, there's a great deal of confusion today over what's right and wrong. We read of the moral decline in politics and business and in so many other aspects of our society. There's talk about the new morality, though I haven't read anywhere where it's been defined. One young lady, sitting in my office not very long ago, used the term, a 19-year-old sophomore, I asked her if she could define the term, and she said, well, I'm not quite sure what it means, but I think that it means just sleeping with anybody that you want to, any time that you want to. However it's defined, I think that it does include the new permissiveness in sexual behavior. It's difficult to assess how much the sexual mores have changed on the campus over the past 5 or 10 years. But that a change has taken place is quite apparent. As you may know, Harvard has been engaged in some open, though at times agonizing, self-searching in this area. Some of this self-searching was in part precipitated by concern expressed not by the ministers, but by the psychiatrists. For the psychiatrists have been the first to see some of the repercussions of this new sexual freedom. And clinical experience has given us the impression that this new freedom is really not what it's cracked up to be. It certainly does not appear to be very much fun when you see it at close hand. It certainly does not lead to ecstatic pleasure, to greater freedom and openness and more meaningful relationships between the sexes, or to exhilarating release from stifling inhibitions. Instead, it results often in turmoil and tragedy. Like so much of reality, it's different than the way it appears to us. Now, Fred Smith said something last night that I liked. And I like it not only because he'd got it from another psychiatrist. He said that we don't see the truth of reality. I'd like to add something to that. It seems to me that life is a continuous process of finding out that reality is different from what it appears. Life is a continuous process of finding out that reality is different from what it appears. Why do we see it so differently? Why do we distort it? Is it because reality is out of focus? I don't think so. I think that we're out of focus. We're somewhat tilted, somewhat upside down. Now, people say that this new sexual freedom is so natural. It's natural. But they fail to realize that there is something wrong with our nature, that our nature is somewhat warped. So that often when we do what is natural, we do what is most harmful. If we did what was natural, most of us wouldn't work. And we'd eat too much. And if Bill Glass did what was natural, he'd step back when these huge blockers come at him. But if he did step back, then he'd be in serious trouble. Those of you who ski know that if you do what's natural, you lean toward the slope where there isn't as much distance between you and the mountain. But then when you do that, your skis slide out from under you and you're in trouble. I think there's a natural tendency in us to veer off of the course that we ought to travel. Certainly, this new sexual freedom is different than what it appears to be. So often it leads to superficial, empty relationships that are merely a testing of one's masculinity or one's femininity. It leads to feelings of guilt, of self-contempt, of worthlessness. One young lady from a very liberal home said that she couldn't understand why she felt so guilty and so unclean. And she told of moods of deep despondency over her behavior and of a strong desire to punish herself. It leads to unwanted pregnancies, this despite the sophistication about the new contraceptive devices. One young man came to me recently, not at all prepared for marriage, wondering what he should do now that he had impregnated two young women. Another young lady came to me saying that she couldn't study. Her period was delayed. She feared that she was pregnant. She didn't know, but she wondered if it would be possible to have an abortion. She said she heard it was just a simple office procedure, and she wondered if it wouldn't be possible to have it done rather quickly so that she could get back to her studies. I had told her that I felt that we'd better talk about this and consider it. First of all, we should have a test to see if she is pregnant, and secondly, this was not a simple office procedure. Many people died from it each year. And often it's done by people that are not qualified, et cetera, et cetera. She said, well, I don't want to wait. She said, could you tell me, here are the names of two doctors in New York Could you just tell me whether or not they're qualified? And I said that I wouldn't, and I asked her to come back to see me the next day. But the next day she didn't show up. Fortunately, she had given me the names of the two doctors. I called one of them in New York. She was at that time in that doctor's office, and we were able to put the brakes on right at that point. But this is what goes on. Sophisticated? Yes. Mature? No. Good judgment? Absolutely not. And so often this behavior leads to disillusionment, to frustration, to despondency, and to attempted suicide. And most of all, it leads to confusion. As with Miss Carpenter, the young lady whose sister was killed, the young people want someone to spell out what's expected of them, some authority, even though they rebel against it. They want it. They want someone to tell them what to do in this area, what they should do. But no one's willing to do that anymore. Certainly not the home, not the church, and the university certainly doesn't. It's been my contention that the universities often sanction or give the impression that they sanction behavior that they in fact don't tolerate. And they do this by lectures that deprecate the Judeo-Christian standards. They do this by their own behavior, the faculty's behavior. They do this at Harvard by allowing the girls in the men's rooms, in the men's bedrooms, for 40 hours a week. And the administration has regretted many times that they've opened the doors about 10 years ago, but now they feel that they can't turn the clock back, even though many of the psychiatrists have recommended that they do so. But our society has repudiated the Judeo-Christian standards, and with this repudiation, everything has become relevant. What one person thinks is as right as another. There's no clearly defined moral precept. The lines between right and wrong have become blurred, and the result is confusion. And the confusion in this area is not confined to the young people. Christianity, of course, proffers moral standards that ring loud and clear. Christian sexual morality is clear-cut. It's marriage with complete fidelity or abstinence. Now, this is hard. It's very difficult. And it conflicts immediately with our inner impulses and with everything and everyone around us. It conflicts with what we see on stage and screen and television, with what we read in books and posters and magazines, and with what we hear on the radio and in conversations with friends. Now, one question immediately comes to mind. Does not this rather strict rule that seems so humanly impossible and so unnatural, does this not lead to severe mental disorder? The answer is no. There is absolutely no evidence that conscious control of sexual impulses is psychologically harmful. People with a little bit of psychology will often mistake the word suppression, which is conscious control of impulses, with the word repression that they read about in psychology texts that state that it's harmful and that it leads to emotional disorder. But repression is something altogether different. It's a technical term. It goes on unconsciously. You're not aware of it when it's happening, and it usually happens very early in life. And when it happens excessively, it does give rise to some problems, often. But suppression, the conscious control of one's impulses, leads not to disorder, but to inner strength. Now, the Christian standard, carried to even a lustful look, is very, very difficult. But as with all of God's standards, it helps us to realize that we cannot come close to attaining it without His help. In Christianity, Miss Carpenter found clear-cut moral precepts. For the first time in her life, she found direction as to right and wrong, and most of all, an inner source to help her live accordingly. Now, a third element of a healthy personality is a sense of identity, a sense of knowing who we are and some understanding of how others see us. The term ego identity is used a great deal in the new psychological terminology, and it stresses the need for an individual to have a clear picture of himself, a clear picture of who he is and what he is to become. The emotional problems that we see most frequently among college students are related to this problem of identity. In late adolescence and in young adults, there's a great deal of confusion over just who they are, what they are, and what they are to become. Some people treat them like children, some people treat them like adults, and they're just not sure who they are. They're also confused about their sexual identity, doubting their masculinity or femininity, and having to test it frequently. Their career identity is often tentative at this age and adds to the uncertainty and turmoil. Now, this identity confusion is intense during the transition from childhood to adulthood, and sometimes it becomes so intense that it results in severe mental breakdown. Whether one experiences this identity confusion mildly or severely, it's nevertheless important that it be resolved. When it is not resolved, an individual may find, among other difficulties, an inability to commit himself to any close personal relationship, in marriage or otherwise, or to commit himself to a career. And some people are still struggling with this in their 30s and 40s and 50s. They still have not found a person with whom they can share their life, nor a job they can commit themselves to. Their families speak of them often as not yet having found themselves. Now, is it possible that Christ can help one to an understanding of who he is and what he is to become? Does the Christian experience in any way help one to find an identity? If there's any truth to the Christian gospel and its assertion that man is created by a creator for the specific purpose of having fellowship with him, then it's not unreasonable to assume that an individual not in fellowship with this creator will have some difficulty understanding who he is, why he is here, and what direction his life is to take. The closer he comes to achieving this position and purpose for which he was created, the more in focus he will become, and the more clear will be his picture of who he is. In Christ, the individual's fellowship with God is renewed, and it seems to me that for the first time, he comes to see himself as he really is. Now, this picture of himself may not be a pleasant picture. He may, for the first time, see through all of the defenses he's maintained to boost his self-esteem. For the first time, he may see his utter selfishness, his vanity, his pride, and how far short he falls of God's standards. It's always been interesting to me that the nature of man, based on the psychiatrist's clinical observations, have often coincided with the nature of man as described by Christian theologians. Freud, in his paper on mourning and melancholia, which is one of his most important scientific contributions in which he works out the dynamics of depression, is talking about depressed people, severely depressed people, and how a depressed person feels worthless and morally despicable and in need of chastisement. But he doesn't say that this is a delusion in the person. Instead, he makes the interesting parenthetical comment that this depressed person may, for the first time in his life, begin to see himself as he really is. But for the Christian, this picture of himself does not have to be brought about by a state of depression. Nor does it lead to depression. For Christ offers forgiveness, the opportunity for a new start, a new beginning, a new life. Christ also becomes one after whom we can pattern our lives. He's the ultimate figure with whom we can identify. Put on the mind of Christ, we're told. But if we become like him, doesn't this mean that we all become alike and therefore lose our identity? I don't think so. For I think that Christ brings out the uniqueness in each personality. C.S. Lewis uses the illustration that it's like stepping from the darkness into the light falling on each individual does not make each individual alike. It brings out the features that make him distinct and unique. Christ helps us in our lifelong struggle of finding our identity. Miss Carpenter, in Christ, found forgiveness, a new inner strength and direction, a new self-image. And this helped her not only in her relationship with herself and her feelings toward herself, but also in her relationships with other people. Now, a fourth factor in attaining emotional maturity is the coming to terms with the realization of one's own death. Death, as with birth, is something we all share. One unique feature of man is that he can foresee his own death. Yet in our society, man seems to do everything possible to deny this reality. Our present-day culture is obsessed with youth and sexual appeal and takes great pains to avoid and deny aging and death. One woman that I'm seeing who's in her 60s and yet who nature has been very kind to and is still so attractive that some of my colleagues, seeing her in my waiting room, have often asked me who she is panicked by the thought of aging. She looks into the mirror every day, notices every new wrinkle. She wears long-sleeved dresses because she's worried that her arms don't look as young as they used to. And she says, if this keeps up, I'm soon going to have to start wearing a veil. Our present-day culture denies death. The word death itself is seldom used. You know, people don't die. They pass on, or some other euphemism is used. In our culture, people don't grow old. They become senior citizens. And the only time you hear the word death is in a joke. The anxiety is so great that all the people can do really is joke about it. Now, it's fine to joke about it, and some of the jokes are very good. The last one I heard concerned three Irish policemen. You know, we have a great many Irish in Boston. They make excellent policemen. These three Irishmen were on the force together for many years, and one of them, named Mike, died. And his two buddies were paying their respects to him. And as they were leaving the wake, one commented to the other, "You know, Mike looks a lot better since he stopped smoking." In our advertisements, parents look like teenagers, and grandparents often like college students. Millions are spent yearly on cosmetics to remove shadows and gray hair, and on surgery to remove crow's feet and sagging chins. In the practice of psychiatry, nothing is more difficult than trying to convince a family that one of its members is suicidal. And this despite the fact that a suicide occurs about every 8 minutes. In the United States, there are 25,000 suicides a year. About 200,000 unsuccessful attempts every year. Now, most of us are born in pain and most of us die in pain. Why this is, I don't know. It's difficult to understand. And of course, it's normal to have some apprehension about it. It entails a separation from loved ones. But just because it's painful, there's no reason that we ought to deny it. That is to pretend that it doesn't exist. Going to the dentist is painful. But if we deny the need to go, then soon we encounter more pain than that which we attempted to avoid. We cannot deny death for very long, because death is a part of life, a part of the reality in which we live. And denial is never a very satisfactory way of dealing with reality. It's a defense mechanism that's used a great deal by a little child. A child who's small and vulnerable uses denial a great deal. He pretends that he's not small. He steps into his father's shoes. And he likes these stories about, like Jack and the Beanstalk, where the little boy kills the giant. And he's always playing soldier, where he's a tough fighter. And in this way, he denies that he's vulnerable and small. But eventually, as he begins to grow up, he has to face this reality that he is vulnerable. We cannot deny death for long without incurring more pain than that which we attempt to avoid. Now, science has contributed to a longer span of life. The mortality rate is dropping continuously. In 1963, there were 9.6 deaths per thousand. In 1964, there were 9.4 per thousand. And every year it seems to be dropping, and we seem to be living longer and longer. But medicine has given us very little understanding of death. The actual cause of death, in many instances, is not understood. Psychiatry has certainly been interested in death, how death is conceptualized by the mind, and what effect death has on those who lose loved ones. But psychiatry has nothing to contribute to how a person comes to terms with the reality of his own death. It's very strange that in our hospitals today, the psychiatrists are being called on more and more to attend a dying patient. And yet, they have precious little to offer. And many of them have written of how relieved they are to find a patient with strong religious convictions, and how gladly they give way to a minister who can offer the dying patient something. It's also very interesting to me that a number of psychiatrists, on the basis of their clinical observations alone, have observed that once this problem of death is resolved in a person, whether late in life or early in life, a change takes place. The individual gains a certain integrity. Some psychiatrists have even said that a person doesn't really live until he has prepared to die. This has been written about in the psychiatric literature a great deal. But if psychiatry has no more to offer in resolving this issue of death than to state that it is helpful to resolve it, then where do we turn for the solution? Of course, there's but one who provides an answer. Christ has resolved this problem once and for all. He alone has provided an answer to Job's question, "If a man dies, shall he live again?" Who in all history can make the claim that whosoever liveth and believeth in me shall never die, and because I live, you shall live also? Miss Carpenter, who was suddenly faced with the death of her sister, was able to deal with this tragedy without disintegration because she had come to know him
who has made death a transition, who has replaced fear and despair with hope and even with anticipation. In summary, then, the person who has had a genuine Christian experience ought to find as part of that experience, as he grows spiritually, a new compassion, a new concern, a new sensitivity and awareness of others, loving others more, although needing them less. Secondly, a new understanding of what for him is right and wrong before God. And this seems to me that it ought to be such a full-time job that he has little time to worry about and to criticize what's right and wrong for other Christians. Thirdly, a new, clearer picture of himself, of who he is and what his direction and what is his direction and purpose in life. And finally, a new inner integrity that comes in having accepted and resolved the reality of his death. It is these aspects of emotional maturity that are fostered in a life totally committed to Jesus Christ. And I think the key here is in total. So often we commit ourselves, but we reserve one small area of our lives. When we do this, I think there are at least three people that know it. God knows it. The enemy knows it, who pushes or pulls us just a little bit to keep us deviating from the path that we ought to travel. And most of all, we know it, and we suffer from it, and we short-circuit our relationship with God. Now, just a couple of comments in closing. I know that if Christianity fosters inner strength and maturity, does this mean that Christians are therefore immune to mental illness? Does it mean that Christians don't become mentally ill? I don't think so. And I think it's dangerous to conclude that a person who needs psychiatric help has been remiss spiritually. What I think we can safely say is that Christian experience involving personal contact with Christ fosters emotional health. And because the emotions are so closely tied to our physical functioning, it may also foster physical health. But I do not think that we can say that it therefore follows that because a person has physical illness or mental illness, that his spiritual life is not what it ought to be. One other point. This inner strength and maturity does not mean a Christian life is or ought to be free of conflict. The Christian life is a battle against inner impulses and against external forces that would pull or push us from the path that we ought to travel. And what is a battle but conflict? Dr. Carl Menninger wrote me a personal letter when I was an intern stating that a Christian ought to expect conflict, for a Christian is swimming upstream. But of course, with the conflict comes greater inner resources to deal with them. One last point. It's interesting to me that psychiatrists write relatively little about religious faith. If there's any truth to Christianity, then it's the most important aspect of human behavior, of human experience. And yet, relatively, they write little about it. And I think it's because most of them don't understand it. It's difficult to understand from the outside. Understanding of Christianity comes only through experiencing it. Freud made profound scientific contributions based on his clinical experience, but when he delved into the area of religion and philosophy, his thinking was not always clear, and this was very obvious to philosophers who reviewed his books. For his biographers also have noted that this was an area of real personal difficulty for him. He just could not understand Christianity. In Corinthians we read, "The natural man does not receive the gifts of the Spirit of God, for they are folly to him, and he is not able to understand them." Yet again, comments made by psychiatrists based on their clinical observations alone, are interesting. Professor Eric Erickson of Harvard, who I believe has contributed more to modern dynamic psychiatry than any other American psychiatrist, made this statement in one of his books, which I believe is very pertinent to what we're talking about. He had this to say about the man with strong religious faith. He said, he is always older, more mature. Or in early years, he suddenly becomes older than his playmates or even his teachers, and focuses in a precocious way on what it takes others a lifetime to gain a mere inkling of. If we were to find one word that would sum up all that I've been trying to say today, I think it would be the word peace. Christ brings us inner peace. And I think the scriptures document this well. And the peace of God, which passeth all understanding, shall keep your hearts and minds through Christ Jesus. In quietness and in confidence shall be your strength. Peace I leave with you, my peace I give unto you. Peace from him which is, and which was, and which is to come. Thank you.